work brings rewards. All of our activities, whether they are great or small, have certain rewards and blessings connected with them if they are honest labor, if they are honest creations or actions. And yet there is no ultimate satisfaction in them. For each satisfying act or deed or creation, there is an end, and yet there is another thing to be done. There is more action and activity. And so it bids us look to the future. In a sense, the very movement of time makes us look to the future. It makes us wonder, what is the ultimate goal of everything? Is everything that I'm doing worth anything? Is it going anywhere? Is there a future in it? We think that way both over the short term and as well over the long term. And this cycle, of course, is now introducing to us a special focus on this question of activity. It's a question of the way that life works and trying to figure it out, what is going on under the sun, and recognizing that, in fact, what we come to, if we come to the right conclusion, is that we must trust one who knows when we do not know. We must trust one who will bring an ultimate purpose to pass in the plan of history and in our lives, and yet we must be content not to know. And he, of course, wants to get us to the place where we work for him and we seek blessing in him and we don't seek it independently. That's the way the whole world around us works. It's constantly trying to suck ultimate satisfaction out of everything in the world that God has given as a blessing, but not finding it because they are ignoring him. And so that is part of the plan, is that we cannot, we must not ignore him. And so the main theme of Ecclesiastes, which is really contentment, fearing God, is now the writer is honing in on that great topic, which will come to its point in chapter 5. And contentment is the theme now that he's aiming at, the writer is aiming at, and he is aiming at it from the perspective that ultimate contentment in this life or in the life to come, and especially in this life with its ups and downs, is only found when we find our trust in the Lord, when we trust that he has a good plan despite appearances at times, and that we may therefore enjoy our lives and trust him through the difficulties. And so a couple of things here this evening. I think we can break this up as we look at verses 9 through 21. There are two sections. One is 9 through 14. Again, unlike the way that my Bible divides it up into paragraphs, but I think that you'll see there's a certain logic here, and that what we have is the 9 through 14 and then 15 through 21. And we have an actual a pattern here, and the pattern is a pattern in which we see an explanation of a what, and then he says, I saw, and then I said, I saw, and then I know. And so you see this pattern in these two sections of this introductory panel. And you see an assertion and then two conclusions that are drawn from it. And we see that twice in the pattern. And if you look at the subject of each of these sections, you'll see that both are telling us to fear God, but God from a slightly different perspective. The first section says, fear him as the creator who is sovereign over all of his creation. And then secondly, fear him as judge, because everyone is held accountable. And so the first is to fear God as the creator who alone understands the big picture. And then secondly, fear God as the judge who alone knows the big picture. And so as we look at this, we frame this in terms of this ultimate or this temporal question of what profit is there in work? Remember, do you remember that question? It's already been raised in verses 1-3. Verse 1-3. What profit has man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? And he makes the statement then in verse 9. After he raises the question in verse 9, in verse 10, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. So we see that the work, that the labors, all of the activities, this isn't just the farmer out in the field, it's also the craftsman, the artisan, the writer, it's every activity under heaven. All of man's labors and endeavors are God-given. So we need to be careful when we come to understand what vanity means in this situation. And they're God-given. And, moreover, he has made everything, and here I wish they had not translated with this word beautiful in its time, because that's really not what it means. It's not an aesthetic judgment. He's not saying everything is pretty to look at. In fact, one of the main points of the book of Ecclesiastes is that it's not pretty to look at, that life is full of ups and downs. It seems to be out of whack. And so what does the word mean? It means useful or appropriate. And this is one of the tough things that we have to grapple with. We can surely see that something is appropriate when it goes well. But when it doesn't, it's hard to see. And remember that verses 2 through 8 are a poem that says that killing and healing, that breaking down and building up, all of these things are all part of God's larger plan. And so that we need to be careful that while we understand that in terms of his being the creator, making everything good, things are out of whack because they're not functioning according to design. We were not designed to die, to go back to the dust. But be careful, because now God has even those negative things, death and sin, are all under his control, and they too, even though they're not according to his design in creation, they are according to his design as the provident controller of history. And this is the thing that we as believers in a fallen world where things appear to be out of whack, and they are according to design, out of whack, that we still may trust that God has a plan that is good, that is beautiful, that is appropriate in its time, that God is the one that is in charge of man's doings. And we see this in some of the great events of the history of redemption, especially the greatest event in Galatians 4, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son. And Jesus, throughout his life, and when we preach through Luke, we notice this, that he was constantly saying, the time is being fulfilled, or it's about to be fulfilled. He understood the appropriateness of what was about to happen to him, because he was part of the planning of it from all eternity as the Son of God. I am not yet going up to this feast, for my time has not fully come. He understood that God was the one who had control of the big picture of all of history with its ups and its downs, that just because things were functioning out of whack, because there was injustice in the world, because there is death and sin, it doesn't mean that God doesn't have a plan and that that plan is not perfect and beautiful. And so what we come face to face with here then is that in all of our acting, there is the great actor with a capital A. And he is the one who has ultimate say over our acting. We oftentimes pit God's sovereignty over against our actions, say he is sovereign and we are simply kind of following the plan. But no, it's that we act, and God acts, and God acts through our acting. And so there are two actors here. There is mankind, and there is God. And what the text is telling us is that God is the one who has a suitable plan for everything, and then he has put eternity in their hearts. Now, this has been a difficult one for translators. And notice, if you look forward to verse 14, you have the same word, olam. It doesn't show up the same, but it is the same. It's in verse 14, I know that whatever God does, it shall be for eternity, forever. Same word. And it can mean a number of things. But what it clearly means here is that God transcends time. He's not at the mercy of time. Time does not control God, but God controls time. He controls the sequence of events. He controls the movement of the ages and the movement of our lives. He transcends time, but he's involved intimately in everything that goes on in time. And I believe that what he means when it says that he set eternity in our hearts is that he has connected us with himself. Whether we acknowledge it fully or not, we have a sense of deity. We know that our work, that our labors, that our significance is in some way or another connected with the one that created us. Even if we fight against it and kick against it and try to suppress it in our sin, we know it's something that is in us. We seek to know the big picture and to understand the ultimate meaning of our lives. In Romans 1:20, we perceive his eternal power and Godhead, even in our fallen condition. We know God is a witness that he, the Creator, transcends the events of the created order in the march of time. And so it is that he calls us then, because we have this sense of deity, the sense of eternity. He calls us to trust him. And I think that one of the themes, not only of Ecclesiastes, but of the whole Bible, is that the events of our lives, especially the ones that hurt, that are difficult, that are challenges, call us to trust him. I have control over what you do not, and you need to trust me. This is what he is telling us through these events. We couldn't know that, of course, without the written word of God. That he alone is sovereign. His working, his acting, his doing is determinative of all of our doing, of all of our acting. And thank God, because if we were in control, things would be a mess. When we are, things are a mess, although it's all in God's larger plan. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure. So then it is not of him who wills nor of him who runs, but of God who shows mercy. Isaiah 65, I was sought by those who did not ask for me. I was found by those who did not seek me. God is in control. And when he says here, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to end, it's simply saying that we are here to acknowledge that he is God, not us. I'd say it's the great issue of human life, this question of who is in control, in ultimate control. And it's why in our public profession class, when I teach on the sovereignty of God, and people have their questions, legitimate questions about responsibility and sovereignty and what this does to our motivation for evangelism and all of these things, but I basically say it's ultimately a question of control, of who is in charge. And the great question of discipleship is who is in control, and the great answer is God is in control. And if you do not fully believe that, and none of us does because we are sinners, he will teach us, and he does. And he teaches us sometimes through hard lessons, but that's what he is all about. That what he begins, he completes, not only in history, but in our lives. And so right in the midst of this then, in the midst of asking us to trust the Creator God who is in control of history, of everything, who has a perfect plan for history and for us, Then he says, I know nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in their lives. Eat, drink, and enjoy the good of his labor. It is the gift of God. And remember what we've said all along here is that the perspective of the writer of Ecclesiastes is not of a cynic. It's not of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, la-di-da, this is all life is, so suck the most out of it. It's not what he's saying. He's saying, truly, Christian, believer, you may enjoy what God has given. It's limited, but it's real. It's temporal, but it's his gift. Enjoy it now, because he has given it to you. But trust, enjoy it, trusting that he is in charge, that he is the giver, and that he is the one in control of your life and of history. Accept it as a gift. Know through his gifts the giver of all of the blessings of your life. It was interesting. I don't know what the background of this was, but one particular Lutheran writer went through and gave an enumeration. Oh, no, actually, it was an Anglican writer that I was using, Derek Kidner. And for some reason, at this point, I guess it's because it talks about drinking and eating, of feasting and enjoying food and drink, and surely drink in the ancient world included a fairly good diet of wine. He was giving all the different places, and I had never done this, but there are about 9 places in the Bible which commend wine as a blessing of God. And of course, in moderation, and it was part of eating. It wasn't something done for its own sake. But I guess he was speaking against a kind, what he called an oppressive fundamentalism, which basically says we really can't enjoy life too much because that would be sin. And it's often attributed to the Puritans, and it's not so. The Puritans were not like that. Maybe a few pilgrims were, but the Puritans, the English Puritans, loved the life that God gave them because they loved the Lord who gave it. And they enjoyed themselves. They had great feasts. The Mayflower, incidentally, and that was pilgrims, they were the strictest of the Protestants that came over from England, had the boat filled with rum. So they weren't themselves even against that. They, of course, were seeking to survive. But the fact was that when they had that first Thanksgiving feast, even though half of them had died, these pilgrims enjoyed that feast unto the Lord, and they ate to the glory of God. Whatsoever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all to the glory of God. And so in this perspective, this is what the text is saying. Enjoy those gifts because God has given them to you. But remember, fear God. Remember who he is. The idea of fear here, of course, it's usually spoken of as filial fear. But I would go farther than that and simply say that it is the fear of love, the love of a child to a parent, which sees that there is a great connection, but that it's an amazing connection because the parent, and here in this case, God the Father, is the Creator. He is awesome. And we respect the fact that the Creator and the creature have an infinite distance between them, but God in his infinite goodness condescends to have a relationship with us. And so it is at the end, or excuse me, now right at the center of Ecclesiastes 5:7, for in the multitude of dreams and many words there is also vanity, but, and this is the center of the book, fear God. And we'll see how Christ is revealed in that section of chapter 5. But then he concludes the book with the same thing. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. And notice here that it says in verse 12, I know that there is nothing better for them to do than to rejoice and do good all their lives. Do good. Rejoice in God's gifts and use them for good. Use them for others. That's one of the beauties of being part of the church, that we share our lives in a very real sense one with another. Now, the second point, verses 15 to 21. Is that we are to fear God as the judge who alone knows the big picture. One thing I didn't add, actually I should add this as I look at 14 and 15, we talked about this, 14, in terms of God being in ultimate control. Notice that when it says that whatever he does is shall be forever, what he's saying is that there is a plan here that is inviolable, that you can't add to or subtract from, and that's what he says. Nothing can be added, nothing taken away. God does it that men should fear before him. So that's as the creator. But now he brings into the picture this question of justice. And that's why 15, not 16, is the beginning of this little section, 15 to 21. Because he says, that which is all, has already been, and what is to be, has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. And what he's saying here is that everything that's done which is unjust, that iniquity and sin, is not being ignored just because it seems like some people, in fact the vast majority, are getting away with it. And so fear God as the judge who alone knows the big picture. God will judge sin that is past. And in a real sense, what the writer is asking here is, what about injustice in the world? It's one of the great vexing issues of life. In the place of justice, judgment, in the courts of the land where justice should be, wickedness is there. It's so interesting that oftentimes this is brought against Christianity. Well, how do you account for all the wickedness and injustice in the world? Well, I may not be able to give you all the final answers that you want in every case, but the fact is that the Bible faces this squarely. The Bible is not afraid of these big questions because it's the Word of God. And so the Lord, through the writer, brings this question into the foreground. What about the fact that there is wickedness where there ought to be justice, and in places where righteousness ought to be, there is iniquity? What do we do with this? Well, it's all part of God's plan, and it shows and reminds us that everything is truly out of whack. That is to say, it is not according to design. Remember how we have defined the word vanity? That it doesn't just mean emptiness, that's one dimension of it, but that it means not according to design, not according to the way that God created it to be. He didn't create us to die and turn into dust. He didn't create us to find iniquity in places of justice or righteousness. It was not designed that way. And so now in verse 16, remember, he brings up this phrase that we've heard before, and I'm amazed that very few commentators seem to get this right in the way that Meredith M. Klein has done. Moreover, I saw under the sun. That doesn't just mean things that are happening on the horizontal plane in history. It means the things that are in a fallen world under the condemnation of God. It could only be in a fallen world under the wrath and curse of God that we find the reasons for this wrath, which is that there is sin, that there is rebellion. That's what it is to find wickedness in the place of justice. It shows that we are fallen. And God, in his mysterious sovereignty, has even planned that this should be the case. But be careful, because this doesn't mean that anyone is going to get away with anything. It doesn't mean that anyone is held guiltless because they are sinners in the plan of God. In fact, we are told of the death of Christ after he was raised from the dead by Peter on the day of Pentecost. He said, "You who by wicked hands have crucified him, this was planned from before the foundation of the world." This was in the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, the wickedest thing that was ever done. But you are not held guiltless as a result. And so here, there is the statement then that God is going to judge. Whatever injustices there are, God is just. He doesn't cease to be just. And how do we know that? Death tells us. Death shows us that God is judging. Even as we live, we see death. We see the witness of death, which shows that God is supremely unhappy with human beings that live in the rebellion of their father, Adam, or their parents, Adam and Eve. And he says, I said in my heart, see, I saw, and now I said in my heart, and then I said in my heart, verses 17 and 18, God shall judge the wicked and the righteous and the wicked, and there shall be a time there for every purpose and every work. Okay, we've just said that. God will judge. Then he said, I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, God tests them that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. Remember Nebuchadnezzar? He had to be humbled by becoming like an animal. And here I don't think it's so much speaking ethically as to say that we become those who are subject to the dust and who act as if we had no relationship to heaven. Animals live and die. They are not made in the image of God. And because of sin, that becomes our position, that we are just like the beasts of the field and that we too are subject to dust. We are drawn into the grave because of the fall of Adam and because of the displeasure of God with lives that are lived in rebellion against him. And so, he says, concerning the estate of the sons of men, God tests them, we're like the animals. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to the beast. One thing befalls them all. As one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over the beast, for all is out of whack. This is where it's so clear to see the definition of the term vanity. Did God create man to return to the dust? No. He created him to eat of the tree of life, to enjoy eternity, to dwell in the great palace of the royal king for eternity, to enjoy God and to glorify him forever. And so this is all out of whack. But death tells us that there is a judge and that he is the one who holds us to account and that he is the one that controls history. And he wants us to know this. He wants us to learn this. This is why it says God tests them. He, in a sense, he tests us in this world by showing us death, by giving us the obituary page in the newspaper every day, so that we will turn our hearts and minds heavenward, so that we will trust in him. The ultimate question, which is brought forward now in verse 21, is who knows? That's what I've titled the sermon. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward and the spirit of beasts which goes down to the earth? See, here's the conundrum, that they both end up going to the dust, and that's vanity. Man was never meant to die. And yet, who knows? Who can figure out the fact that man's spirit rises heavenward? That is because man was made in a unique way in the image of God to know and love and serve him, the Creator. That's what we're made to do. And so who knows? The answer is clear if you take the whole of the Bible into account. And even in this text, the answer is there. The God who knows the beginning from the end. The God who has an appropriate plan for history and for your life. He knows. He knows. And people of God, this means that you and I are called on this Lord's Day evening to trust the God who knows the beginning from the end. He is the one who has the big picture. He is the one that has the ultimate goal and fulfillment of our lives at the end of history in his hands. He says, and it is Jesus who reveals this in the ultimate way, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, says the Lord, who is and who was and who is to come, the Almighty. And then at the end of Revelation in chapter 21, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. Who thirsts, you see, to know the Lord. In The Hound of Heaven, Francis Thompson, one of the great poems of English literature, near the end of the poem, he says, "Whom wilt thou find to love ignoble thee? Save me, that is God. Save only me. All which I took from thee, I did but take, not for thy harms, but just that thou mightest seek it in my arms." So Thompson is saying there that God brings difficulties and troubles into our lives so that we will seek all good from him. And so we must trust him, them. The God who knows, we must trust the Alpha and the Omega for the past. Everyone has a past. Forgiveness of sin becomes so important as we trust him for our past. Indeed, he is just. When he says, "If you, O Lord, should mark iniquities, O Lord, who could stand? But there is forgiveness with you, that you may be feared." We see in the book of Revelation that the Lamb is the only one, that the Lion out of the tribe of Judah is the only one who can unlock the scroll of history, because he has forgiveness. He has redemption. And then we need to trust God for the future, leaving the results, the purpose, the fulfillment for all of our labors in life, in the church and outside of the church, in his hands. "I wait for the Lord. My soul waits," says the psalmist, "and in his word do I hope." Peter puts it even more explicitly in gospel terms when he says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled, and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed at the last times." We sang about the resurrection, even though I was hinting that we could sing Advent hymns. That was good. We broke tradition, and we pointed to the fact that in the incarnation, the ultimate fulfillment is in the resurrection. That Christ comes and he suffers, he lives, he dies, and then he is raised from the dead. And here is a hope that time cannot corrupt. Here is a hope that does not end in the dust. Here is a hope, really, in which all other activities and hopes are wrapped up. And then finally, we trust him in the present as the one who knows, serving him. "And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him," and being content that he is in control, that he will give us all we need in this life, and he will bring us to the day of Jesus the Christ.